60. But we are given only one conscience, too. While this story was being told, Shtchakov had put a high gloss on his well-worn but still respectable calfskin boots, donned what had been his dress uniform, after cleaning and pinning on his medals and sewing the wound stripes on his sleeve. Army uniform, alas, was becoming fatally unfashionable in Moscow, and Shtchakov would soon have to join in the desperate scramble for suits and shoes, and set out for the Kaluga gate on the other side of Moscow. He had been invited, through his army friend Eric Sonkin Golovanov, to a party at the home of public prosecutor Makarygin. The party was mainly for the young, but it was also a family occasion to celebrate the award of the Red Banner of Labour to the public prosecutor. Some of the young people present were not, in fact, very close connections, but Daddy was footing the bill. The girl whom Shtchakov had described to Nadia as his fiancée was sure to be there. There was, in fact, nothing definite between them, and it was time for him to press harder. That was why he had called Eric and asked him to arrange an invitation. With a few opening remarks in readiness, he climbed the stairs, where Clara was always reminded of the woman she had seen cleaning them, and entered the apartment in which, 4 years earlier, the man whose wife he had just nearly stolen had crawled on his knees in ragged quilted trousers, laying the parquet floor. Apart from tightening his hold on his intended, what Shtchakov most devoutly hoped to get from that evening was his fill of appetizing food. He knew that the best of everything would be provided in unsinkable quantities. He also knew that guests at such feasts were doomed to behave as though they were there simply to amuse one another, feigning indifference to food and barring the way to it. Shtchakov must continue to entertain his opposite number, exchanging jokes and smiling politely, while appeasing his stomach, which was shriveling thanks to the student refectory. He did not expect to see a single genuine soldier at the party, anyone who, like himself, had threaded his way through mine lanes and stumbled wearily over ploughed fields in what was grandiosely called an attack. His comrades were scattered, lost forever, killed in the hemp fields outside some village, or against the wall of a barn, or on an assault craft. And he was entering this warm and comfortable world alone, not to ask, "Where were you, you bastards?" but to become one of them, and to eat his fill. Perhaps his habit of dividing people into soldiers and non-soldiers no longer made sense. Some people found it embarrassing to wear even the combat medals that had once cost them so dearly and shone so brightly. You couldn't accost everybody and ask, "Where were you then?" It made less and less difference whether a man had fought or dodged the draft. There is a time to remember and a time to forget. Life is for the living. The dead have their glory. Shtchakov pressed the bell. The girl who opened the door was presumably Clara. There were already quite a few coats, men's and women's, hanging in the little lobby. The warm party atmosphere reached him there, the cheerful buzz of voices, music from a record player, the clatter of crockery, a medley of joyous smells from the kitchen. The telephone rang out there in the lobby, and Clara lifted the receiver, urging Shtchakov with her left hand to take his coat off.
"Ink? Hello? What? You haven't left yet? This very minute? Ink, you know Daddy will be offended. Even your voice sounds feeble. Oh, well, if all you can say is, I just can't... Hang on, then. I'll call Nara."
"Nara!"
she shouted into the next room.
"Your ever-loving is on the line. Come and speak to him."
To Shtchakov.
"Take your coat off."
He already had.
"And your galoshes."
He wasn't wearing them.
To Nara. "Know what? He doesn't want to come."
Wafting perfume from some exotic clime, Clara's sister Dutnara came into the lobby. Shtchakov knew from Golovanov that she was married to a diplomat. She was strikingly handsome rather than beautiful, and she moved with the graceful ease that is the glory of Russian womanhood. She took the receiver and began talking affectionately to her husband. She was in Shtchakov's way, but he felt no need to hurry past this fragrant obstacle. He stood looking at her. Padded shoulders were very much in fashion, but Dutnara looked all the more feminine for refusing to hide the delicate curve of her upper arm. There was something else unusual about her dress. She was wearing a sleeveless dress, but over it a fur-trimmed jacket with slit sleeves gathered at the wrist. Not one of the three, standing so awkwardly close together in the cosily carpeted lobby, could have imagined that disaster lurked in that innocent, shiny black tube, and that trivial discussion about coming or not coming to a party. That afternoon, Reuben had ordered additional recordings of calls made by each of the suspects. This was the first time Volodin had answered his telephone since then. As he raised the receiver, a tape in the central exchange of the Ministry of State Security began rustling and recording the voice of Innocenti Volodin. As a precaution, he had decided not to use the phone for the present, but his wife had gone out, leaving a note. He was to be at his father-in-law's that evening without fail. He was calling now to beg off. After yesterday's call to the embassy, was it really only yesterday? It seemed ages ago. The suspense had become harder and harder to bear. He had not expected to be so agitated, never imagined that he could be so afraid for himself. He was seized by dread in the night, certain that he was about to be arrested. He longed for morning to come, so that he could leave the house. He had spent the whole day in a state of restless anxiety, understanding nothing of what was said to him, and not even listening. Regret for his impulse was compounded by craven terror, but by evening those feelings had degenerated into apathy. He no longer cared what happened. It would probably have been easier for Innocenti if that interminable day had not been a Sunday. He would have been in the office, looking for clues as to whether his posting to the UN in New York was going ahead or had been cancelled. But on Sunday there was no way of guessing whether the holiday lull held peace or menace. Throughout the last 24 hours, his call to the embassy had seemed to him suicidally rash. Nor could it possibly do any good. And anyway, to judge by that dithering idiot of an attaché, they were not worth defending. There was nothing to show that he had been found out, but his heart ached with an inexplicable presentiment, and the anticipation of disaster grew stronger and stronger. The last thing he wanted was to go where people were enjoying themselves. He was trying to persuade his wife, speaking hesitantly, as people do when they have something unpleasant to say. His wife persisted, and the peculiarities of his individual speech pattern were recorded on a narrow strip of magnetic tape to be turned into the sound pictures on wet film that would be laid out before Reuben the next morning. Dotty was not talking in the peremptory tone she had adopted in recent months. Softened, perhaps, by the weariness in her husband's voice, she begged him to come, if only for an hour. Innocenti gave in. But when he put down the receiver, his hand remained on it, and he stood motionless, as though letting his fingerprints be taken. He felt that he had left something unsaid. He suddenly felt sorry, not for the wife with whom he had lived and lived no longer, and whom he meant to leave forever in a few days' time, but for the fair-haired 10th-grade schoolgirl, with curls down to her shoulders, whom he used to take dancing between the tables at the Metropole, the girl with whom long ago he had begun to discover what life was about. Their passion was fierce, impervious to reason, and they refused to hear about waiting a year before they married. Innocenti's mother, already seriously ill, was against it. But what mother does not oppose her son's choice? So was the public prosecutor, but what father light-heartedly surrenders a charming 18-year-old daughter? But against all opposition, the young people got married, and their unclouded happiness was a byword among their common acquaintances. Their married life began with the very best auguries. People in their social circle did not know what it meant to go anywhere on foot or to use the metro. Even before the war, they preferred flying to a sleeper on an express train. They never had to worry about furnishing an apartment, wherever the young couple went, in the countryside around Moscow, in Tehran, on the Syrian coast, in Switzerland. A fully equipped dacha, villa, or flat would be waiting for them. Their outlook on life was identical. No inhibitions, no obstacles must come between wish and fulfillment. "We are people who behave naturally," Dotnara used to say. "We don't pretend. We wear no disguise. Whatever we want, we go all out for." As they saw it, we are given only one life, and so must take from life all that it has to offer. But not perhaps a child, because a child is an idol that sucks the vital juices out of you and repays you with no sacrifice of its own, not even with gratitude. With views such as these, they were well suited to their milieu, and it was well suited to them. They were eager to sample every new exotic fruit, to learn the taste of every rare brandy, and what distinguished the wines of the Rhone from those of Corsica, and of all the earth's vineyards besides, to wear every kind of clothing, dance every dance, swim at every resort, sit through two acts of every unusual theatrical occasion, page through every book that made a stir. For 6 of the best years in a man's or a woman's life, each gave all that the other could ask. 6 years that largely coincided with those in which much of mankind were saying heartbreaking farewells, dying on the battlefield or under the rubble of shattered cities. Years when crazed adults were stealing crusts of bread from children. The world's grief did not pale the cheeks of Innocenti and Dutnara. We are given only one life, remember? But in the 6th year of their married life, when the bombers were grounded and the guns fell silent, when tremulous green shoots were struggling through the black cinders, and people everywhere had begun to remember that we only live once, all the fruits of the earth, all that it is good to smell, to feel, to eat, to drink, to handle, palled on Innocenti and began to disgust him. Alarmed by these feelings, he fought against them as though they were an illness. He hoped in vain that they would pass. The worst of it was that he could not explain them. It might seem that everything he could wish for was within his grasp, but something important was lacking. At 28 and in perfect health, Innocenti felt that his own life and the life of all around him had reached a dead end. He stopped enjoying the company of close friends who had once amused him. This one suddenly seemed unintelligent. That other was coarse, yet another too full of himself. But it wasn't just his friends. He began to detach and distance himself from the flaxen-haired Dotty. He had long ago started using this Europeanized version of Dutnara's name, from the wife to whom he used to feel indissolubly joined. There was a time when the thought of her was a piercing joy, when he could never tire of her lips, even when he felt lifeless and despondent. He had known no other lips like hers. Of all the beautiful and clever women he met, Dotty alone existed for him, and suddenly he could not help seeing in her a lack of refinement, and began to find her opinions intolerable. Her remarks about literature, art, and the theatre in particular, now seemed to him invariably wide of the mark, jarringly crude and imperceptive, and she delivered herself of them so categorically. Sharing silence with her was as good as ever, talking to her more and more difficult. Innocenti began to feel cramped by their monotonously glamorous lifestyle, but Dotty would not hear of any change. To make matters worse, instead of ruthlessly abandoning things in favour of something new and better, she had developed a habit of greedily treating as permanent possessions all the things she found in each of their apartments. Dotty had used her 2 years in Paris to send home big cardboard boxes full of lengths of fabric, shoes, dresses, and hats. Innocenti disliked this, but the more glaringly their wishes diverged, the more emphatically she insisted that she was right. Had she only recently acquired, or had she always had, unnoticed by Innocenti, that unpleasant way of chewing, or rather chomping, especially when she ate fruit? The trouble, of course, lay not in his friends, not in his wife, but in Innocenti himself. There was something lacking in his life, and he did not know what it was. His friends had long ago decided that he was an Epicurean, and he readily accepted the label, without really knowing what it meant. Then one day, at home in Moscow with nothing to do, he had had the amusing idea of reading what his master had in fact taught. He started searching the cabinets left by his late mother for a book about Epicurus that he remembered seeing in his childhood. Going through the old cabinets was a task Innocenti began with an unpleasant sensation of stiffness, a reluctance to bend, to move heavy objects around, to breathe dust. Even this was unusually hard work for him, and he soon tired. But he forced himself to go on, and a refreshing breeze seemed to play on him from the depths of those old cabinets, which had a ripe smell all their own. He found the book on Epicurus, among other things, and read it later. But more important was what he discovered from her letters about his late mother, whom he had never understood and to whom he had felt close only as a child. Even her death had left him almost unmoved. In early childhood, a vision of silvered bugles raised toward an ornate ceiling and the song, "Let Leaping Flames Light Up the Blue Night," had fused with Innocenti's idea of his father. A father whom he did not really remember at all. He had been killed in 1921, suppressing the peasant rebellion in Tambov province. But he was surrounded by people who never tired of telling him about the heroic naval officer's glorious role in the Civil War. Hearing those praises sung everywhere and by everybody, Innocenti began to feel very proud of his father and his fight for the common folk against rich people wallowing in luxury. Whereas he rather looked down on his anxious mother, nursing her unspoken grief in the midst of her books and hot water bottles. Like most sons, he did not stop to think that, besides himself and his upbringing, his mother had some sort of life of her own, that she could be ill and suffer. And now she had died at the age of 47. His parents had spent hardly any time together, but this too was something the boy had no occasion to think about, and it never occurred to him to question his mother. Now the whole story unfolded in her letters and diaries. Their marriage was not a marriage, but a whirlwind event, like everything in those years. Circumstances had flung them roughly and briefly together. Circumstances allowed them to see very little of each other, and circumstances parted them. But in these diaries, his mother was revealed as not just an appendage to his father, as their son had been accustomed to thinking, but as someone with a world of her own. Innocenti now learned that his mother had loved another man all her life, and had never been able to marry him. That it was perhaps only for the sake of her son's career that she had borne, till the day she died, a name that was alien to her. Stored in the cabinets were bundles of letters tied with coloured ribbons of fine fabric. Letters from girlhood friends, and from friends and acquaintances of later years, actors, artists, and poets, long forgotten or mentioned nowadays only disparagingly. Old-fashioned exercise books with blue Morocco covers held his mother's diaries, written in Russian and French in her strange hand. It was as though a wounded bird had skimmed the page and scratched an erratic trail with its faltering claw. Recollections of literary soirees and theatrical events took up many pages. He was deeply moved by her description of herself, an enraptured girl, standing on the station in Petersburg one white June night among a crowd of admirers, all weeping for joy as they welcomed the Moscow Arts Theatre Company. Pure love of art reigned triumphant in these pages. Innocenti could think of no such company nowadays, nor could he imagine anyone missing a night's sleep to welcome it, except those dragooned by the Department of Culture, carrying bouquets funded from the public purse. And obviously, no one would ever dream of shedding tears on such an occasion. The diaries led him on and on. There were pages headed Ethical Notes. "Goodness shows itself first in pity," said one of them. Innocenti wrinkled his brow. Pity? A shameful feeling, degrading to the one who pities and the one who is pitied, so he had learned at school and in life. Never think yourself more right than other people. Respect other people's opinions, even when they are inimical to yours. That was pretty old-fashioned, too. If I have a correct worldview, can I really respect those who disagree with me? He almost forgot that he was reading and seemed to hear clearly his mother's frail voice. What is the most precious thing in the world? I see now that it is the knowledge that you have no part in injustice. Injustice is stronger than you. It always was and always will be. But let it not be done through you. If Innocenti had opened the diary 6 years earlier, he would not even have noticed those lines. But now he read them slowly and with surprise. There was nothing esoteric in them, and much that was simply untrue, but still he was surprised. Even the words in which his mother and her women friends expressed themselves were outdated. In all seriousness, they began certain words with capital letters: truth, goodness, beauty, good and evil,
the ethical imperative.
In the language used by Innocenti and those around him, words were more concrete and easier to understand. Progressiveness, humanity, dedication, purposefulness. But although Innocenti was progressive and humane and dedicated and purposeful, purposefulness was what all his contemporaries most prized and cultivated in themselves. Sitting there on a low stool by the cabinets, he felt that something he had lacked was stealing into his heart. There were also albums of old photographs, clear and sharply defined. Several separate bundles consisted of Moscow and Petersburg theatre programmes. There was the theatrical Daily Spectator and the Cinema Herald. He hadn't realised that they went back so far. And piles of magazines, all sorts of magazines. Their names alone were enough to make a man dizzy. Apollo, Golden Fleece, The Hyperborean, Pegasus, World of Art. There were reproductions of unknown paintings and sculptures, not a trace of any of them in the Tretyakov Gallery, and of stage sets. Poems by unknown poets. Innumerable magazine supplements with dozens of European writers of whom Innocenti had never heard. But it wasn't just individual writers. There were whole publishing houses long forgotten, as if the earth had swallowed them. Griffin, Dog Rose, Scorpion, Musagetes, Halcyon, Northern Lights, Logos. He sat there for days on end, on the little stool by the wide-open cabinets, breathing their air, intoxicated with it and with his mother's little world, which his father had once entered, wearing a black raincoat, girded with hand grenades and bearing a Cheka search warrant. Early 20th century Russia, with its ideological battles, its dizzy proliferation of trends and movements, its unbridled imagination, and its anxious forebodings, looked out at Innocenti from these yellowing pages. Russia, of the last pre-revolutionary decade, which he had been taught at school and in the Institute to regard as the most shameful and most barren in Russia's history, a decade so hopeless that if the Bolsheviks had not come to the rescue, Russia, left to itself, would have rotted and collapsed. It had indeed been a garrulous decade, too sure of itself at times, yet somehow impotent. But what a proliferation of new growth! What a burgeoning of new ideas! Innocenti realized what he had been robbed of till now. Tatnara had arrived to carry her husband off to some official reception. Innocenti had stared at her uncomprehendingly, then frowned, picturing that pompous assembly where everybody would unreservedly agree with everybody else, where all would spring to their feet with alacrity to drink the first toast, to Comrade Stalin, then eat and drink a great deal with no further thought of Comrade Stalin, and then play cards like idiots. His eyes returned from an unfathomable distance to his wife, and he begged her to go alone. That anyone should prefer poking about in old albums to real life at a reception seemed crazy to Dutnara. Innocenti's finds in the cabinets were bound up with vague but never dying recollections of his childhood, and they meant a great deal to him but nothing to his wife. His mother had triumphed. She had risen from the grave and taken her son from his bride. Once launched, Innocenti could not stop. If he had been misled about one thing, perhaps there were others. For some years now, he had lacked both the wish and the energy to study. His fluent French, which had been such a help in his career, he had acquired in childhood from his mother. But now he began reading avidly. His blunted and jaded appetites gave way to this new passion for reading. He found, though, that even reading was a special skill, not just a matter of running your eyes along the lines. He discovered that he was a savage, reared in the caves of social science, clad in the skins of class warfare. His whole education had trained him to take certain books on trust and reject others unread. From boyhood he had been sheltered from erroneous books, and had read only those that were warranted sound, so that he had got into the habit of believing every word, of submitting without question to the author's will. When he began to read authors who contradicted one another, his resistance was low, and he could not help surrendering to whichever of them he had read last. What he found most difficult of all was to lay down his book and think for himself. Why, he wondered, had the February Revolution disappeared from Soviet calendars, as though it was an insignificant detail in the chronology of 1917. Why, indeed, were they so reluctant to call it a revolution? Perhaps only because it made no work for the guillotine? But the Tsar had been overthrown, and with him a regime 6 centuries old at a single push, and nobody rushed to pick up the crown. Everybody sang and laughed and exchanged congratulations. Yet there was no place for this day in a calendar that meticulously noted the birthdays of greasy swine like Zhdanov and Shcherbakov. Whereas October 1917, which all Soviet books in the 20s called a coup, was magnified as the greatest revolution in the history of mankind. What were Zinoviev and Kamenev accused of in October 1917? Of betraying the secret of the revolution to the bourgeoisie. But can you prevent a volcano from erupting by looking into the crater? Can you block the path of a hurricane when you receive a weather report? Could they have betrayed the secret? Only the secret of a narrow conspiracy. And that tells us everything. There was no elemental, nationwide flare-up in October. All that happened was that the conspirators assembled at a given signal. Shortly afterward, Innocenti was posted to Paris. There he had access to all shades of world opinion and to all Russian émigré literature, though, of course, he had to look over his shoulder at bookstores. He could read and read and read, though his duties, of course, got in the way. Until then, he had thought that his job was the best and his lot the luckiest he could possibly have hoped for. But now he began to feel that there was something sordid about it. Being a Soviet diplomat meant not only delivering day in and day out statements at which people with their heads screwed on right were bound to laugh. The other part of the job was more important, the secret part. Meeting characters with code names, collecting information, passing on instructions and money. In his carefree youth before his crisis, Innocenti had seen nothing reprehensible about this backdoor business. He had thought it fun and made light work of it. Now it was distasteful, repellent. The great truth for Innocenti used to be that we are given only one life. Now, with the new feeling that had ripened in him, he became aware of another law, that we are given only one conscience, too. A life laid down cannot be reclaimed, nor can a ruined conscience. But there was no one, no one at all in Innocenti's circle, not even his wife, to whom he could tell all these new thoughts. She had not understood or sympathized with the belated affection he had felt for his dead mother, nor did she understand why anyone would take an interest in events that were over and done with, never to return. If she had known that he had begun to despise his job, she would have been horrified. This job of his was the foundation of their glittering prosperity. The gap between them had widened so far in the past year that he could no longer risk revealing himself. But even on leave in the USSR, Innocenti had no intimates. Touched by Clara's naive story about the cleaner on the stairway, he had hoped for an instant that here at last was someone he could talk to freely. But from the first steps they took, the first words they exchanged on their walk, he saw that he was mistaken. Impassable thickets lay between them, too dense to disentangle and tear asunder. And although it would have been quite natural for him to complain about his wife to his wife's sister, and although that would have brought them closer together, he was disinclined to do it. Why? For one thing, a strange law decrees that it is futile trying to develop an understanding with a woman if she is not physically attractive to you. Somehow your lips are sealed. You are paralyzed by the hopelessness of trying to say all you need to say. Frank and simple words elude you. Then again, he had not gone to see his uncle, had made no effort to go when he should have. What was the good? A complete waste of time. There would be nothing but tedious, pointless interrogation and exclamations of wonder about abroad. Another year went by, in Paris and in Rome. He arranged to go to Rome without his wife, only to learn on his return that he had shared her with an officer on the general staff. She was unrepentant, indeed stubbornly self-righteous about it, and shifted all the blame onto Innocenti. He should not have left her by herself. Yet he felt no pain, no sense of loss, but rather relief. Since then he had been at a desk in the ministry for 4 months, in Moscow the whole time, but they lived like strangers. Divorce was out of the question, however. It would ruin a diplomat's career. And Innocenti was marked out for posting to the UN Secretariat in New York. This latest posting pleased him, but also frightened him. He liked the United Nations as an idea, not its charter, but what it could be, given a general willingness to compromise and to avoid malicious point scoring. He was very much in favour of world government. What else could save the planet? But that was the spirit in which Swedes or Burmese or Ethiopians could go to the UN. He was propelled by an iron fist at his back. Once again he was packed off with a secret mission, an undeclared purpose, a double memory, and a poisonous hidden brief. During those months in Moscow, he did at last find time to visit his uncle at Tver.